VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And thank you for joining us today on Crosstalk here on VCY America. Scripture tells us that we are to study to show ourselves approved unto God, workmen that need not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Ladies and gentlemen, few sections of the Bible have been as controversial and perhaps highly debated as Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. And so for context, let me just read these verses, and we'll be delving into them today with our guest. And it came to pass when men began to multiply in the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, that they took them wives of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he is also is flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years. There were giants in the land, in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. So the questions really abound. Who were the sons of God mentioned here? Who are the daughters of men? What about these giants, the term giants or Nephilim in the land? Well, our guest today has conducted extensive research into the various views and is going to be unfolding his research today as well as his conclusions. As we welcome to Crosstalk today, Tim Chafee. Tim is the director of Risen Ministries. He's served in the position of a pastor. He's been a youth pastor. He's the author of nearly two dozen books, including Old Earth Creationism on Trial. He's had a Noah trilogy, Noah Man of God, Man of Resolve, and Man of Destiny. He's been with us on Crosstalk discussing his book in defense of Easter, written other books as well, but he's a researcher, he's an apologist, and with us today discussing his latest book entitled Fallen, The Sons of God and the Nephilim. And Tim, so good to have you back with us on Crosstalk.
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
This has been a matter of great controversy, this passage of Scripture. What caused you to even launch into this topic here?
Yeah, well, let me say from the outset, some of your guests may recognize me from being at Answers in Genesis as well. And as a ministry, Answers in Genesis doesn't take an official position because it doesn't really come down to necessarily a biblical authority issue on this particular one, you know, your different interpretations. And so as a ministry, they don't take a position. So what I'm saying today is my own view and shouldn't be viewed as Answers in Genesis. But with that disclaimer out of the way, one of the words you read in, I believe you were reading from the King James Version of the mm-hmm. of the passage, talks about giants on the earth. And well, you've seen me when I walked in here. I'm about 6'9", and I've been called that, the term giant many times, the Hebrew word Nephilim. I've been called that many times as well. And I just thought, what is it with this passage? And so I've always been kind of interested in things that are a little bit weird, a little bit odd, you know, with some of the passages in the Bible. And I thought, when I was doing my THM, my Master of Theology degree, I had to do a thesis. And I thought, well, what better passage to do than this one and to really get into it? And so I started doing some research, trying to find some dissertations or other people who had done a thesis on it, and there was very little out there.
Did that surprise you?
It did surprise me. I thought mm-hmm. somebody would have done some really extensive work on it, but most of what I had seen online is filled with a lot of really bad arguments. Even people who might agree with my view utilize some arguments that I think are pretty poor. There's so much misinformation. Then there's a whole bunch of stuff that I would say that's kind of conspiracy laden, you know, where people just take it off into the fringes. And I thought, can't there just be a really serious Bible study on this topic without getting into all of that? And so that's what I set out to do.
Why is there so much emotional reaction to this topic?
Well, I think part of that, two reasons, I think. There's one of the positions is known as the fallen angel view or the divine beings view. And so that would mean that the sons of God were these fallen angels who they had rebelled against God and they married women and had children with them. So that sounds disturbing to a lot of people, and I think rightly so. And so there's an emotional reaction because of that. But then there's also, in reaction to that view, people instantly go to Matthew 22:30, where Jesus talks about how, you know, that when we die, believers are going to be like the angels in heaven who neither marry nor given in marriage. And mm-hmm. they say, well, Jesus said that can't happen. So therefore, that view is wrong. And if you hold that view, you're saying Jesus was wrong. How dare you?
And we're going to be delving into that further
right.
later.
So I think those are two reactions that people mm-hmm. give. And you can understand why they might be upset about that.
So what you seek to do in this book here is to present the different views, weigh the evidence. That's your approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as we find this passage in Genesis chapter 6, what is the context? What is leading us up to this point? Because it's good for us to have that understanding.
Yeah, so it's right at the beginning of Genesis 6, just the introduction to the whole flood account. So before that, you have, you know, Cain kills Abel in chapter 4, and then the end of chapter 4 follows the line of Cain and kind of tells you how that ends up. And then it goes back at the very end of chapter 4, tells you about Seth's line a little bit, that Seth has a son, or Adam has a son named Seth. And then chapter 5 is that genealogy from Adam to Noah. And we keep reading, you know, they lived 900 years and he died, 969 mm-hmm. years and he died, and all of these things. And then suddenly you get this subtle, well, not really subtle change, it's a really drastic break in the text. And it talks about this passage, which seems to come out of nowhere. And then it introduces the entire flood account, the next several verses about how wicked the world was, and that the world was filled with violence. Every thought of man's hearts was only evil continually, and mm-hmm. God was grieved that he had made man. So it's smack dab in the middle of all of that.
And so in the time frame, man's time frame, what was going on at that time?
So this would have been any time between creation and the flood, sometime in the years leading up to the flood. It doesn't give us a specific date as far as, you know, when this was happening. Mm-hmm. It's just sometime before the flood. And I think that verse 4 also tells us it was happening after the flood.
Okay. Perhaps of all the questions we're going to ask today, this might be the easiest. Okay. Who are the daughters of men in this passage?
Well, that would seem to be the easiest one, because in verse 1, it tells us that men began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born to them.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like it's telling us this is people in general, and the daughters being born to them would be the people in general. But then the very next verse says that the sons of God saw the daughters of men. A couple of the views will limit the daughters of men to only men from a certain line, from either the line of Seth or the line of Cain. But there's no justification for doing that in the text itself. You've just seen daughters were born to them, men in general. Why would it suddenly shift from all people to just this specific group in the very next verse?
So there were also many sons and daughters from Adam and Eve, too.
Right, yeah. So there's other lines than just Seth and mm-hmm. and Cain going on, mm-hmm. because Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters, Genesis 5:4. So the daughters of men is just the women in general.
Okay.
It's just a way of saying, just like sons of Adam, sons of men would be a phrase for men in general, like it says in Genesis 11 with the Babel event. Mm-hmm. It talks about God coming down to see what the sons of men had built. It's just a general term.
So, Tim, one of the key areas of debate is who were the sons of God in this passage? And another question is who were the Nephilim? But the King James uses the term giants in this as well. Were giants, just as a key point, were giants the same as the Nephilim?
Yes, and that's one thing that people will make a mistake of. They think that the word Nephilim comes from the Hebrew verb nephal, which is to fall, and they'll say, well, if you try to, you know, the word giants is taken from that, or the word Nephilim is from that, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you try to make a participle from that word, it actually becomes something different. It becomes Nophilim or Nephulim. It does not become Nephilim, the way that the Hebrew language works when there's a morphology that happens when you're taking a verb and making it a participle. So really what the word means, it's the, sorry to get a little technical on that one, but the word Nephilim is actually, there's an Aramaic noun, which is Nafil, and that means giant. And so the plural would be Nephilim in Aramaic, and when you make it plural in Hebrew, the N changes, the I-N ending in Aramaic becomes an I-M as in Mary ending, Nephilim. It just means giants. And that's how they're described in Numbers chapter 13, the only other place where that word is used. So that makes perfect sense. That's what the Bible is describing there.
Tim Chafee, our guest today, he's author of the book Fallen, The Sons of God and the Nephilim. And Tim, you spend the first half of your book speaking of the sons of God. There's no way we can possibly cover the hundreds of hours of research that you poured into this book itself. So you're going to have to summarize each of these major views here for us today. But I'd like to begin with that very popular view called the Sethite view, which says that the sons of God were the male descendants of Adam's son Seth. Tell us about that view.
Yeah, so that one, people will look at Genesis chapter 5, that line from Adam to Noah through Seth, and they'll say, well, this is a godly line because you've got Adam and you've got Enoch, who we know is godly, and Noah is a godly man. And so they're saying that this represents a godly line, then the people who followed Cain that you read about in Genesis 4, that must be the ungodly line. And so in Genesis 6, what's happening, the sons of God must be this godly line from Seth, and they're marrying these women from the ungodly line. And so what you have is a a marriage between godly and ungodly, which we know the Bible talks about. That's not a good idea. And so that's been a very popular view throughout history. I think that in my research when I'm looking at what scholars say about the passage, that's diminishing a bit among scholarship, mm-hmm. But it's still out there at the popular level. A lot of people hold that view. But it clearly was the most dominant view in church history from about the 5th century until about 100 years ago. That was very, very popular.
We can't get into all the discussion on it, but in your book, you actually take all of the positive arguments for this view and evaluate them. What do you see as being the most substantive support for this view?
The most substantial? I think that it doesn't have to draw from very far outside the context. So you do have in Genesis 5 a line of Seth, and you do have a line of Cain in Genesis 4. So I think that as far as support, they can point to those two things without going very far. But what I found for this view and for one of the other ones that we'll talk about, what I call the royalty view, mm-hmm. Or some people call the divine tyrants view, I think most of their arguments are negative arguments against the fallen angel view. It's more of a reaction against that they're trying to build their case. And so what I wanted to do is, here's the positive arguments that they use mm-hmm. in support of their own view. Mm-hmm. So I think that the close context one is probably the best argument they have.
But you also say there's problems with this view as well, the Sethite view.
No, there's substantial problems. I mentioned one earlier about the daughters being born to men. That's men in general. So you have no justification in verse 2 to suddenly say, no, this is just the daughters from the line of Cain. Why would, you know, a believer marrying unbeliever result in giants, which is verse 4 tells us there, if you read it carefully, that the giants are the offspring of these unions. That doesn't happen today with believer and marrying unbeliever. Why would God judge the entire world with a flood when believer marries unbeliever? And if these guys were so godly, why were they continually, over and over and over again, marrying ungodly? And the Bible never said that line is godly. We know that Enoch was. We know that Noah was. We don't know anything about the rest of them, whether they were or not. I'd like to think that they were, but we know by the time of Noah, everybody else was ungodly. It wasn't, so we shouldn't assume that everybody in that line was a godly person when the Bible tells us that Noah, God says that you alone are righteous before me in this generation.
So there are many other arguments as well that you present in your book itself, and listeners will be telling you how you can obtain a copy of the book, Fallen, here by Tim Chafee. We're just a minute from a break, but let's introduce that second view that you present in the book called the royalty view.
Yeah, the royalty or the divine tyrant view, as some people say. What that looks at, it says the sons of God were these rulers. They were judges on the earth or kings or they were nobles. And what they did, their sin would have been that they were taking women, any that they chose, because the wording in the text will say that they took wives. And that sounds like a forceful thing. And so it says that they were taking wives into their harems. And so the sin there would be polygamy. And we see certain things like that in the ancient Near Eastern cultures. You even see that later on in the Bible after the flood, where people, you know, kings would multiply wives to themselves, something that Deuteronomy forbid them from doing, but they were doing it. So that would be the description of that view.
But we're going to take a quick break. Tim Chafee is with us here today, and again, we're discussing his book, Fallen, The Sons of God and the Nephilim, and we'll be back in 1 minute taking up that third view and delving further into that, as well as some of the arguments that have come both for and against that view. A little bit later in the program, we'll be giving you opportunity to call in and weigh on the topic as well. You're listening to Crosstalk on the VCY America Network.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, creation author with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, you say that there was no death before Adam sinned. But what about plants? Didn't Adam eat plants?
Yes, Chris, Adam and Eve did eat plants in the Garden of Eden. But was this really death in the biblical sense? There's a profound theological distinction between plants and animals in the Bible. Both man and the animals are described as having life, Hebrew nephesh, which plants don't have. The term life is reserved for those animals in whose nostrils is the breath of life, and also by the fact that life is in the blood. Plants have neither breath nor blood. Thus, the eating of a plant in the Garden of Eden wouldn't necessarily involve death. Plants are biologically alive, but they're not biblically alive in the sense that they do not have true life. You see, Chris, there's always an answer to the anti-creationist questions. Back to Genesis. Now that works.
Thanks, Dr. Morris.
We'll be right back. Well, never before in the history of Crosstalk have we devoted a whole program to this topic here from Genesis chapter 6, 1 through 4. And what I'm finding is that one program is no way enough time to really discuss the full extent here. Tim Chafee is our guest today, author of the newly released book. It's called Fallen, the Sons of God and the Nephilim, and talking about the views as to who are the sons of God defined in this passage, who were the daughters of men, what about the giants in the land, so forth. Just before we pick up our discussion here, where we left off on that royalty view, Tim, I know that this book you have available through your website, mm-hmm. where people can go online and order it.
Yeah, they can get that at Risen Ministries, so it's risenmin.com. They can find it there. Just click on the shop link, and that'll take you to a store, or it's available on some other online retailers as well.
risenmin.com, and click on shop. And friends, it really takes careful reading and evaluation. But one thing I appreciate, Tim, it's not a highly technical book. Mm-hmm. One can read it without being a scholar in the various languages and understand the points that you're making in the book.
Yeah, that was my goal. I mean, originally I wrote this as my THM thesis back in 2011 is when I defended that. And I had that available as a booklet for a while. It was about 145 pages, and half of it was footnotes. And it had a lot of the technical things. And so I spent 8 more years refining that and breaking it down to the lay level. Mm-hmm. And there are a few technical areas, but most of them are in footnotes. Right. I try to keep that to the minimum because I want this to be accessible to anybody. And it's much longer than the 145 pages. Right. Now it's almost 500.
Right. So risenmin.com, and click on shop. You'll find the book there, Fallen. We were talking about the royalty view before the last break took place. Some problems with that view, though.
Yeah. So the idea that these tyrants were taking wives, as the language says, well, the people who look at that view said that that's a negative thing. But the Bible never uses that in a negative sense. What Abraham took Keturah as wife after Sarah died. Isaac took Rebekah as wife. It's the same term. It just means they married him. It doesn't mean that they married multiple wives. That's not, the text doesn't, it's not clear one way or the other. Mm-hmm. You know, if you said that multiple men married wives, did they each marry one? Did they marry multiple? You don't know for sure because the wording is just, it's vague in that sense. So there's no way for us to know if that's what was going on. And again, why bring such a harsh judgment? Why would the unions, you know, of that result in giants? So what the people who hold to those two views we've looked at so far, they'll say, well, it doesn't mean giants, it just means fallen ones. And so these people had fallen really far away from God. Interestingly enough, we use that word in a moral sense, that somebody had fallen from grace or something. The Bible never uses that word in a moral sense like we do. I wasn't able to find a single example where we say somebody has fallen in that sense, in a moral sense.
But, fallen into sin or something.
Yeah, something like that. But we use it. But certainly the Hebrew doesn't have it like that. So there's problems that way in terms of supporting it. I guess the biggest problem is the Hebrew word phrase translated as sons of God is B'nei HaElohim. And what they need that to mean, Elohim needs to refer to judges or to kings. They need it to refer to an individual human being. And yet nowhere else in the rest of Scripture does Elohim ever refer to human beings. It always refers to an entity who is from the spiritual realm. 90% of the time, it's God himself. Many times, it's these false or pagan gods or lesser beings, you know, angelic beings. It can be angels, and even demons are called that in Deuteronomy 32:17.
Well, as a matter of fact, in your book, right after you talk about the royalty view, you present, and just before you present the third view, you state that properly defining the word Elohim is of utmost importance. Is that why?
It is, yeah, because it really comes down to that. If these are just, if these are human beings, well, then why are they being called something that term is never mm-hmm. used for human beings elsewhere? The only time it is clearly used, well, I shouldn't say clearly because that's even debatable, 1 Samuel 28, when King Saul goes to visit the medium at Endor and tries to call up Samuel, and I think it really was Samuel's spirit. Some people think it was a demonic imposter, but either way, that spirit is called an Elohim there. So even if it is Samuel, it's his spirit coming back from the spiritual realm that is called that. And if it's a demon, well, then it still fits with what I've been saying, that it's somebody mm-hmm. from the spiritual realm.
You present something in your book called the Divine Counsel. It's a new term for many. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, if you look at Psalm 82:1, if you have a copy of the ESV Bible, it'll say that God takes a stand in the divine council, he judges among the gods. And what you have there in the Hebrew is Elohim stands in the midst of the Adat-El, which is the council of God, he judges among the gods, judges among the Elohim. That's what it says. So Elohim stands in the divine council. He judges among the gods. And as you go through that psalm, he is the one creator, all-powerful God, the God of the Bible, is castigating these other entities that he's charged with ruling justly, and yet they haven't been doing that. And then he announces his judgment. And that's what Psalm 82 is all about. So the term divine counsel comes from Psalm 82.
Mm-hmm. When somebody hears that and hears about all these other gods out there, is there polytheism going on?
Well, I think we need to define that carefully, because the Bible does speak of other gods. You know, Baal is called a god. Dagon of the Philistines is called a god. The Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. Mm-hmm. And when the Psalms talks about how he is a great God above all gods, he's not saying he's great above all these non-existent things. That's not praise at all. He's saying he's greater than all these other spiritual forces that people have called gods. So really what they are these rebellious angelic beings. So they're beings from the spiritual realm that in the Bible's not afraid to call them gods over and over again. Even Paul does that in 1 Corinthians.
Small g.
And small g, yeah, small mm-hmm. g, but it's still the same word. It's the word, Elohim functions very similar in Hebrew as the word God does. And I think part of the confusion is in English, whenever we hear the word God, we instantly think the one true God, at least people from a Judeo-Christian background. Mm-hmm. And it's understandable why that might people might think of polytheism right away, but that's not what it's saying. These are created beings. They are not all powerful. They are, if you think of them just as being angels that God has put in a, you can see this council in a few places, actually several places in the Old Testament. When Micaiah has this vision, when he goes before Ahab and Jehoshaphat in 1 Kings 22, he says, I saw Yahweh seated on the throne, the one true God seated on the throne, and all the heavenly host around him. And then he says, who will go and persuade Ahab that he may fall at remote Gilead? And one spirit says this, another one says this, and then another one comes forward and says, I'll go. And Yahweh says, what will you do? And he says, I'm going to go and be a lying spirit in the mouths of his mm-hmm. prophets. And God says, go. Well, who is this spirit that's up there in heaven or in God's throne room saying, I'm going to go and lie to mm-hmm. these? It's one of these members of the divine council. And you see this throughout Scripture.
So we could not say that divine counsel are all godly.
That's true, yes. Just mm-hmm. I think one of the ways for us to think about it, because it does, our sensitivities toward the word God, we tend to, like you talked about, people think, is it polytheism? No, God doesn't need their help. He does ask their opinion. He allows them to participate, but he's the one who decides. He's the one who orders. He's in charge the whole time. And it's very similar with us. He doesn't need us to be doing these broadcasts to get the message out, but he chooses to use us, and he allows us to participate in what he's doing. Why would that be different in the heavenly realm?
Tim Chafee, your guest here today on Crosstalk, and I'd like us to get into that third view that you present, the fallen angel view. You say this is the greatest number of arguments to support it, but it also you acknowledge that there are also a number of objections to this as well. So let's discuss this fallen angel view.
Yeah, I mentioned there's a lot of objections. There are five chapters in my book just to the objections, because I want to give them a fair hearing like I've done with the other ones. But the term B'nai HaElohim, which is translated as sons of God in Genesis 6:2 and 6:4, appears in a few other places in the Bible. For example, three times in the book of Job. And one time, we know for certain it's not referring to human beings, because it's talking about Job 38:7, when God is saying, Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth, when I did this? And he says, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or I think I switched those two around. But so they're in Hebrew parallelism, they're referred to as morning stars, the sons of God. People weren't there yet. This is before man was created. Mm-hmm. So we know very clearly in that usage, the B'nai Elohim refers to angelic beings. Then in Job 1 and 2, same book, same author, says there came a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And that's where you get the challenge between mm-hmm. Satan and the Lord. That's in Job 1:6, and also in Job 2:1, almost the exact same phrasing. These are spiritual beings. They're heavenly beings coming before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. So,
do we not also have sons of God used of man himself? I mean, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name?
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, that's switching over to Greek. That's in the New Testament. It's different terminology. So it'd be weoi theou is the Greek for that. But notice what it says, that you have the power to become sons of God. And almost every time in the New Testament when it talks about us being sons of God, it's in a future tense, that we will become, that is what we shall become. Now, there are two places where it says you are children of God. But it's speaking of that positionally, if you look at the context. So it's something that we are, but it's not completely there yet. And so the whole creation is longing for the revealing of the sons of God, Romans 8 talks about. So that Jesus even talks about in the resurrection that we will be like angels, being sons of God. At that point, so that's in Luke 17. He talks about how at that point is when we're going to be sons of God, when we're sons of the resurrection.
Okay. So more on this fallen angel view.
Yeah, so not only does the terminology fit the best as far as what the B'nai Elohim means, but it's the earliest view by far. The early Jewish writers before the time of the New Testament clearly held this view. There are a lot of writings from the intertestamental period that spoke of this. There are even New Testament references, I believe, that refer to this. So you've got 2 Peter 2:4 talking about the spirits in chains. Jude 6 talks about those spirits, talks about them sinning in the days of Noah. You have 1 Peter 3:20 that talks about the divine long-suffering waiting in the days of Noah. But right before that, it talks about how Jesus went and preached to the spirits in prison. So you have three mentions of these spirits who sinned in Noah's day. They did something. This wasn't a general rebellion, when Satan fell. It's something else that had happened. And even in Jude, it puts it in the same context with sexual immorality, what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. And so it seems very clear in those passages that's what's being discussed. And the early Christian writers, all the way up through the middle of the 3rd century, all held this view. That anybody that wrote about it, they held this view. And it really wasn't until the hermeneutic of allegory, the allegorical interpretation, became popular among Jewish writers. That's when that view shifted for them, and they held to something like the royalty view. And then among Christians, it wasn't until about the time of Augustine, so in the early 400s, and he allegorized quite a bit as well. He held to this. He adopted the Sethite view, and from his point on, that was the dominant view in the church until about 1900.
Now, I need to mention, Tim, you've covered that very, very fast,
yes.
but in your book, you actually have 4 chapters presenting. There's a chapter, Arguments from the Old Testament, 1, Arguments from the New Testament, from ancient Jewish writings that you mentioned, also writings from church history. And when you combine all that together, brings your conclusion.
Right. Yeah, so I know I did rush through quite a bit, but there is a lot there, and it very clearly is the earliest view in church history. But, church history doesn't determine our doctrine, but we should allow ourselves to be informed by what other godly men and women have said before in the past. But I think this view can be clearly developed from Scripture. It also would explain, why the Nephilim were on the earth, both before and after the flood. The other views can't explain how they got there after the flood, because everybody was wiped out during the flood except for the 8 people on board the ark. But this view can explain that.
We're butting up against a break here, but we've got a whole lot more to discuss here, especially getting into the Nephilim and further breaking down this. Matter of fact, I want to look at an objection or two to this view as well. So we'll be back in just a minute, and stay tuned here. This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Tim Chafee is our guest, author of the book Fallen. Back in a minute.
From Ray Comfort and Living Waters comes the dramatic film Audacity, tackling a very divisive issue today, homosexuality. Challenged by a co-worker to defend his convictions about homosexuality and same-sex marriage, Peter has to consider if he has the courage to stand for what he believes, even at the risk of losing a friendship. How will he respond when faced with a harrowing life or death experience? Audacity uses a unique approach to address a very contemporary issue and challenges the viewer to reach out and approach the greatest spiritual need everyone faces. Audacity is a 55-minute powerful dramatic film that will impact your life. Get your copy of Audacity for a donation of $5, or 5 copies for a donation of $18, 10 copies for $25 when you call 1-800-729-9829. That's 1-800-729-9829.
Well, if your interest has been piqued, folks, you can get a copy of the book Fallen by Tim Chafee. You can go to his website at Risen Men. That's short for ministries, risenmen.com. And click on the word shop, and you'll find the information there. Also, Tim, just before we continue on as well, you're in the area because you're speaking at Falls Baptist Church right now, Menominee Falls.
Yeah, that's right. Normally at this time of year, they would be doing a VBS, but because of the coronavirus and all the changes that happened, they're doing something they call the Worldview Extravaganza for the Family. So I've been speaking there each morning. Yesterday was three times. This morning, just their main session. I'll be there tonight, again, speaking to their young adults, and we're going to be talking about some of the modern myths that people have about Jesus. So that'll be a lot of fun. That'll be at 7 o'clock if anybody wants to come out for that. And then the rest of the week, they're running it from about 8:45 in the morning till noon each day, and they've got a lot of things for the families, for men, for women. I think tomorrow is their men's day, so men, come on out. And I'll be speaking Friday night as well. That will be the closing session. I think that begins at 7, but double-check their website or something to be sure of that. And that one's going to be talking about the creation-evolution debate and those two different worldviews, not just different views of our past, but also of our present and our future. And you're going to see how distinct those two things are.
Go online for Falls Baptist Church. You'll get all the details on it.
Yeah.
Tim, we were talking about the various views here of Genesis chapter 6. And there's many objections to this fallen angel view, one of which is that angels are said, and you quoted this early in our interview today, like in Matthew 22:30, in the resurrection, that a man neither married nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels. Could you address that objection to this view?
Yeah, and I think it's so important because that's the one that most people will jump to right away. And here's the thing, if Jesus ruled this out, it's out. Okay, I'm not going to argue with Jesus. And there's no reason to write the book if that were the case. But if you look closely at what he said that they are like the angels in heaven, neither marrying nor given in heaven, nor given in marriage. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about angels who are in heaven. We're talking about angels who left their proper abode, as Jude talks about, and they came down and they're rebelling against God. Jesus didn't say what angels are capable of doing. He said what the holy angels who are still in heaven do or don't do. He didn't limit their powers at that point and say, they can't possibly do this. So really, people are looking at that passage and expanding the meaning of his words beyond what he said.
You spend multiple chapters even talking about arguments against this view as well, which I wish we had time to get further into, but we don't. Some would say that by accepting the fallen angel view, you're just giving credence to Greek mythology. How do you respond?
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, you know, when we look at flood legends from around the globe, or we look at some of the creation myths around the globe that seem similar to what we read in the Bible, and there's hundreds of flood legends that we found, the anthropologists and missionaries have found as they travel around, you know, reaching these new tribes, new people groups. We look at that as evidence for the Bible. You know, often we say, well, look how similar that is because the Bible gives us the real account, and then here are these things that are echoes of that. You know, they have some distortions, but there's similarity there because people had this history passed down from Babel. Well, this is the same thing. We find this idea around the globe as well, where the gods, you know, think of the Greek gods coming down and having affairs with women and producing demigods. You have that Norse mythology. You have that in some of the Native American mythology. You have this in many places around the globe. I think it's because that's something that really happened in prior to the flood and those traditions, and even after the flood. And those traditions got handed down, and there were distortions. And you know what's interesting? The Bible doesn't dwell on it, and it often doesn't dwell on the capabilities of rebellious angels, because I don't think God wants us really dwelling on that very much, because there is a fascination that people can have with power, and certainly Satan and his angels are powerful. So I think we need to be careful about that. But I wouldn't see that as an argument against. I would say that's what we should expect to find, and we do find it.
Well, what is most problematic to the fallen angel view?
For me, it's the can they physically do that? You know, I don't look at it in a disturbing light, and I mean that from a physical point of view. You know, a lot of times I think people think, wait, these demons, like warty, toady creatures, came, and it's gross. No, but if they think more like if they've seen the Avengers movie, something like Thor. You know, they're not going to appear in the ugliest, grossest way possible. They're going to
Satan himself
manifest as an angel of light. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's what they would. It would be something that would be very attractive. So from a physical point of view, you don't think gross, but are they capable of doing that? Well, we know that angels were able to grab Lot by the hand and yank him out of a city, and the men of that city were interested in you know, molesting them. Mm-hmm. And we know that they can eat and drink. Earlier in that chapter, we read that with eating and drinking with Abram. So we know they can do all sorts of physical things. Mm-hmm. Why would the limit be placed there?
So much more, but let's move on to the Nephilim. Who are they? What do we know?
Yeah, so the Bible tells us in verse 4 that the Nephilim were on the earth, or the giants were on the earth in those days, and also afterward. And there's a one small word right after that, the Hebrew word asher, and many Bibles translate it as when, but you can look at Hebrew grammars, and many of them will list right in that, in this case, it should be translated as whenever. And that change, that little subtle difference, it makes all the difference. It says the giants were on the earth in those days, and also after, whenever the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bore children to them, meaning the Nephilim are the offspring. They were on the earth before the flood. They were on the earth after the flood. Well, who's writing that? Moses. Did Moses know if they were there after the flood? Yeah, he tells us in Numbers 13. He talks about how the spies were in the land, and they saw the sons of Anak, and the Anakim are of the Nephilim, is what we read in Numbers 13:33. He names three of them in the land, and people say, well, the spies were lying. No, Moses, the inspired narrator, is telling us all of that before the spies ever speak, that the giants were in the land. So Moses writes about them before the flood and after the flood, and they're the offspring of these illicit unions between fallen heavenly beings and women.
Are they ever mentioned in the New Testament?
That's a good question. There are a lot of people who hold my view who think that they are. The demons that we see in the New Testament, many people who hold my view think that they are the departed spirits of the Nephilim. So the ones that were drowned in the flood, or maybe even killed in the Promised Land when Joshua and the Israelites marched in there and wiped out the Anakim from every place except for Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. They'll say, well, the spirits wandered the earth and those are the demons. I'm not persuaded of that. I'm not convinced. I do have a chapter where I give the arguments for that view and some of the objections to it. I haven't really decided. I can see some of the arguments, but I don't find them to be all that compelling.
Let me just launch one other matter here. In Matthew 24:37, it says, but as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Is this something the earth is going to anticipate once again?
I don't think so. That's one of the arguments that you'll see, and I think I have that at the end in a chapter about arguments that we shouldn't use. In fact, I save that for, I think that's chapter 29 or 30. It's way at the end, and I don't want anybody looking at that and say, oh, this is Tim's argument. No, I've already given you 20-some-odd chapters of arguments for this. I think Jesus is just speaking of the immediacy of his return, that people aren't going to be expecting this, that they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage and until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and took them all away. They were unaware.
Evil continuously.
Yeah, they were just going about their daily lives, not mm-hmm. thinking about the Lord. And the same thing's going to be true when Christ returns. People are going to be going about their daily lives, not expecting it. And I don't think he's saying the conditions that were there before the flood in terms of all everything have to be repeated. I mean, it could be, but I don't think that's what the verse is demanding.
Let's open our phone lines today on Crosstalk. Our number 800-733-9829. Friends, we don't have time for long discourses. Maybe you got a brief question you'd like to ask Tim today. Here, maybe something he has said has puzzled you. Would you like him to briefly address? The book is voluminous, nearly 500 pages, but he breaks it down again on a layman's level. Our phone number to Crosstalk is 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829. Before we pick up our first call here, Tim, just explain, why does all this matter?
Yeah, that's a good question. Should I take the rest of our time?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned one earlier, and actually you read the verse I was thinking about quoting in 2 Timothy 2:15, to rightly divide the word of truth. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important for us to have a proper understanding of God's word if we're able to do that. And so many times I see a lot of really poor arguments being made for my position or against it, and I just see a lot of confusion in the church on this issue, and I thought, well, let's get to the bottom of it. So I think that's one important reason. There's something else that we don't have time to unpack here, but it helps us explain the issue in the Promised Land when God said that in certain places they were to wipe out men, women, and children. And if you dig into that really deeply, I think besides the city of Jericho, the only places where they were told that is places where the giants were.
Interesting.
The other places they weren't. And so one of those big objections people have to God's character is, or he's telling them to do all this. It was only in those places. Because other times he said you can make an offer of peace to them and they can become your servants, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Our phone lines are packed. Let's get right to our calls. We have John calling in. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. This stuff is based on Babylonian stuff where they believe that Moses plagiarized their writings, and so did David. I mean, it says right there in 1 Peter that, you know, there are eight people in the ark, and God has no other, there are no other gods. So he's not a mob leader. He's not, you know, a divine counsel. He's not going to get something from demons.
Okay, what about this divine counsel? Does God get counsel from demons?
Well, I think if you look at Psalm 82, you'll see right there where God is really hammering them because they haven't been doing what they're supposed to do. But 1 Kings 22, anybody can turn there and look at it, and God is speaking to these angelic beings. They're the host of heaven, Micaiah calls them. And you have one of them right there in the Lord's presence who says he's going to go and be a lying spirit. That's obviously not somebody who's telling the truth. And he's going to be the one who's in the mouth of the prophets of Baal who are there telling Ahab all this bad thing. So God is in control over all. He's not just ruling over the heavenly angels. He even uses the wicked people to accomplish his purposes. And why would he not be able to do that with wicked angels? Even Satan accomplishes his purposes.
John, thanks for the call. Sam is calling from Chandler, Arizona. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the call. In verse 4, where it says, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, my question is, wouldn't the angels need the equipment to do that and have the ability to procreate?
Okay.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that we had talked about. You said, mm-hmm. What do you think is one of the strongest objections? Or one of the problems is the question of, are they capable of doing that? Mm-hmm. And we know that they can manifest physically. They can grab Lot by the hand, pull him out of the city. The men of that city of Sodom desired, so they obviously looked human, very human. They were able to eat and drink. They can do all sorts of things. And if that's what this passage is talking about, then the passage is telling us, yeah, they can do that, and they did do that.
Okay. Let's go to George next in Milwaukee. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I appreciate your discussion, Tim. I don't think that I agree with you, but if you could just comment on Michael Heiser, number one, and then two, when Jesus responded to Psalm 82 in John 10, 34 and 35, but my viewpoint was always that after the flood, there were no more Nephilim, and there just weren't anymore. And then when you're saying that there were, I have always thought, like in Joshua when the spies went in, that those were just large people. They're still large people today.
Okay, George, we're going to have time is going quickly, and let me have you've addressed brought. Many points up here. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so Michael Heiser has written a book called The Unseen Realm, and I've got a review of that on my blog. People can find that if they go to my website and look at it. I would be pretty positive toward that book. I don't agree with him on everything, and he doesn't share my view about, you know, creation, the age of the earth, and other things. But right. On that point, and we'll pick up a couple of the other questions.
Yeah, we'll pick up some more here on the other side. Thank you, George, for the questions. Back in a minute. You're listening to Crosstalk.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewreport.com. Jesus said to the religious leaders of his day that they could discern the weather, but they could not understand the times. The signs of the time are all about us. The stage is being set for Bible prophecy to be fulfilled. Notice what I said. I'm not saying it's being fulfilled right now, but the stage is being set for it to come to pass. The signs are everywhere. Good will be called evil. Evil would be called good. Today, if you are a conservative Christian, you're now a racist. We see the falling apart of moral values. Even the ability to defend one's own home. Have you heard about the couple in St. Louis that defended their home against a Black Lives Matter mob? Well, now the governor of Missouri is saying he'll pardon them if they're charged. But why should they ever be charged? They didn't break the law. The state law allows them to defend their property. Gold and silver are hitting highs for the last several years. There's talk of digital currency and much more. Are you noticing the signs of the time?
As I mentioned before, never have we discussed a whole program on Genesis 6 verses 1 through 4. And today I find out one program is definitely not enough. Several programs, no doubt, to really get into it, but also to give you opportunity to call in with your questions and so forth. And it's a really great discussion to have. And that's really what you wanted to do, Tim, is to delve into these things, present these views, and do some in-depth research on this. The caller here before the break came up also mentioned about John chapter 10, referencing back to Psalm 82.
Yeah, and he also asked about, he always thought the spies were lying, and the point I made, and in fact there's a whole chapter in the book, chapter 20, is all about were they lying, and it gives some of the different positions. But the point is, Moses already told us in the narration that the giants were there. He names three of them, Talmai, Sheshai, and Ahiman. These are the sons of Anak that were in Hebron. He names them. They're not, so he's not making it up. They're not lying. The spies were telling the truth about the people in the land, about them being large, but they were cowardly. That was, the spies were cowards, whereas mm-hmm. Joshua and Caleb were saying, let's go.
Yeah.
So in John 10, in verse 30, Jesus said, I and the Father are one. And then the Jews around pick up stones to stone him, and because you being a man, make yourself God. You know, that was the big objection they had. And then he quotes Psalm 82. And he says, isn't that written in your laws that I said you are gods? And people will look at that verse and they often say, oh, see, Jesus is saying I'm just like these other people in the Old Testament. No, that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus had just said, I'm equal to the Father. And then they pick up stones to stone him. And he says, oh, you misunderstood me. I'm just a man. No, that's not what Jesus was saying. He's right. saying, I'm divine. You want to see who I am? Look at Psalm 82. That's me. And that's why he quotes that verse.
Let's go to our next caller, Brookfield, Wisconsin. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have to say this topic is so fascinating, and I'm so glad that you have it on today. My question is, I had a discussion with a Jewish person, and they believe that God created everything, so God created evil. So our discussion first started with, you know, the Satan and demonic angels. And he said, well, God created evil, so this is all created. And I didn't know how to respond to that. Could you just give me a good answer?
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, I hope so. Exodus 20, verse 11, God says, for in 6 days, or Moses tells the people, for in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. Heavens, plural, and all that is in them. So during that 6 days of creation, God made all the physical things we see. He also made the spiritual beings as well. And at the end of those 6 days, in Genesis 1:31, we see that everything was very good. Satan had not fallen yet. But obviously, sometime between day six and when he tempts Eve in the garden, at some point during that time, he falls. So God, when God made him, he was good. Everything was good when God made it. So
where does evil come from then?
Well, it would be from the decision made by, just like when we do it, it's our decisions that to act in contrary to God's word or contrary to what God has set out. So when Satan decided to rebel, he chose to sin. He chose to rebel. The Bible doesn't give us really specifically why or where that came into his heart or into his mind. It could have been pride. It could have been maybe envy of Adam. Mm-hmm. Adam's given a whole world and a wife, and he's not even as powerful as Satan, and yet Satan doesn't have that. I'm not sure. That's speculation.
Thank you, Kathleen. Melinda is next. Go ahead, Melinda. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, what is your opinion on the Book of Enoch and the fallen angel? Thank you.
Yeah, so the Book of Enoch is one that often gets brought up in this topic, and it really doesn't even come up in my book until like chapter 10 or 11, and it's only as one of the historical sources that, here's one of the many sources from the intertestamental period that held that view. But a lot of people who share my position will use that heavily. I don't like doing that. It's not part of Scripture. It's not inspired by God. Now, there is a verse in Jude where Jude quotes from that, mm-hmm. and it has to do with God returning and bringing judgment on the ungodly. Jude 14 and 15 are quoting from the Book of Enoch. But I don't view it as being inspired. It's helpful in the sense of telling us what did the people at that time in about the 2nd or 3rd century B.C., what did they believe about this topic? They clearly held the fallen angel view.
Thank you for the call. Pastor Mark in Missouri, you're on the air.
Hello. Wanted to talk about Psalm 82. And, you know, if you by reading this psalm, he's dealing with men. He's dealing with Old Testament representatives, whether they are judges or they are kings. and he is dealing with them, judging unjustly and favoring the wicked. And I was going to refer also to the scripture that deals in John chapter 10 with Jesus doing the same thing with those that were judging unjustly and favoring the wicked, the Jewish religious leaders. So I guess my point would be, how do you get that, if I'm understanding you right, sir, how are you getting that these are demonic spirits or things like that? Or maybe I'm hearing you wrong. I don't know, but these are Old Testament representatives that are judging unjustly.
Yeah, that's a good question, and there's three chapters devoted to the divine counsel in the book. I think it's chapters 5 through 7. But it tells us right away that God takes a stand in the divine counsel, and he judges in the midst of the gods, in the midst of the Elohim. That word is not used of judges elsewhere. There are some Bible translations that will do it a couple of times in the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy, and I go through all of those to show why, when you look at other translations, it'll say that you bring them before God and why that's the appropriate translation. But even in that passage, if you go down in verse 6, I said, "You are gods, sons of the Most High," which is very similar to what we just saw, sons of God, all of you. "Nevertheless, like men you shall die and fall like any prince." If they're men, why did God say you're going to die like men? Of course they're going to. If they're not men, and he says that, now it has a greater meaning. But even that, in verse 5, if this is just Israelite judges, why are all the foundations of the earth shaken because of what these beings are doing, because of what these rulers in Israel are doing? Why are all the foundations of the earth shaken because of that? No, this is something that we don't have time to unpack it, but it goes back to what happened at Babel. At that point, God disinherits the nations. He sets them under the authority of these rebellious beings. He said, "You don't want me? Fine, you're going to have this. And then I'm going to make a nation out of one man, out of Abram." And that's what we read in the next chapter. So that, what I just talked about, comes from Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 through 9, where it's talking about Babel.
And in Psalm 82, I respectfully disagree with you, because you didn't include verse 3 and 4, which says, "Defend the poor and fatherless, do justice to the afflicted and needy, deliver the poor and needy." That's not something that's an Old Testament representative that's not being fair to the people.
That's what the heavenly beings were supposed to be doing, teaching the people into righteousness, and they weren't.
Our closing theme is coming on. I wish I had more time, Pastor Mark, and others trying to call in today. We have run out of time, but thank you for the call and for the challenge as well, as Tim has looked at this and the various views, and certainly to be praying God give wisdom and discernment. You can go to his website, risenmen.com. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.